Hello, everybody, and welcome to this month's extended free preview of our What a Cartoon Movie episode all about South Park, bigger, longer, and uncut. I am one of your hosts, Bob Mackey, no relation to the giant-headed man in this movie who is here with me today.
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert, and I am full of BIC, which is Latin for generosity.
And you'll hear many facts like that in our over five-hour podcast about this movie. I dare say this podcast is bigger, longer, and uncut, but we actually do a lot of editing on these. Actually, our editors do. I'm not taking the credit for all that. But yes, if you keep listening, you're going to hear an extended free preview of that five-hour podcast. If you want to hear the entire huge thing, please head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Sign up at the $10 level. You'll get access to the rest of this podcast, plus the entire What a Cartoon Movie library going back over 3 years now.
Yeah, it's a huge back catalog of it, and this one was chosen because it was on a list of movie adaptations of shows we've covered on What a Cartoon, and this one won with a handy margin, so I'm pretty sure our listeners really want to hear this one. We had a lot of fun both looking at some parts that didn't age very well, other parts that are kind of interesting, and just in general for me and Bob to relive what it was like to be there at the apex, to be young and at the apex of South Park's popularity with the release of this film, and seeing it in theaters. Like, we can tell you about the jokes that make way more sense if you are in 1999 watching it in a movie theater.
It was much, much more shocking to us simple 1999 citizens.
And we have a ton of background info on how it was made. Why is Brooke Shields in this movie? Well, you're going to find out if you listen. That's at about hour 3.5, I think. Yes. But yeah, we had so much fun. And so if you sign up at the $10 level at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, you get to hear the full 5 hours and 7 minutes long podcast and all of the previous ones that we're now in our fourth year of doing it. 3 years in the past are in the fourth year now. So many. I think we're over 40 of them now. I think so.
Yeah. It's a lot of listening. And that's on top of all the $5 stuff. If you're not a patron yet already, there's all the mini series we have, over 100 episodes of those, if you haven't heard those yet.
Mm-hmm. And so please check all this out. And now, you Uncle Fuckas, enjoy this free preview. This had the interesting thing of coming right at the peak. And also, it did kind of, like, in its own way, change the show, because after it was done, Matt and Trey said they don't want the show to be this anymore. And they completely changed the show. Like, that's rewatching this, I was like, hey, wait, where's Butters? Where's this character? Where's that character?
Yeah, this was really before South Park was the topic show. Mm-hmm. That would really grow in the 2000s. In the early stage of South Park, we talked about this on our South Park podcast, but it was very much like Simpsons-inspired, where, no, it's about a town and these characters. How many of these season one characters are just missing now? Like, yeah. Where are the mayors? Where are the Bar Bradys? We all know what happened to Chef, but mm-hmm. the cast was culled so severely, and big new characters came along to reinvent the show.
Like, I remember in season 4 or 5, they killed off the bus driver lady, and they just joked about, like, yeah, she hadn't even appeared on the show in a while, but we figured people might care if she died. Like, so we do that. But yeah, so I'm going to pick up where Bob left off in that Christmas 2020 podcast. If you want to hear all about the spirit of Christmas, how Matt and Trey got their start, their struggles in Hollywood that eventually led to, like, overnight success after 3 or 4 years trying to make it in Hollywood. But yeah, so South Park has debuted, a massive hit, bigger than everybody expected it would be, breaking ratings records every week. Like, it would... It seriously felt like this in its first 6 episodes, that it was like, this is the biggest ratings on Comedy Central ever. Next week, the biggest ratings on cable that week. Next week, the biggest ratings on cable ever. Yeah. The next week, the biggest ratings, it beat network shows. Like, and as Comedy Central nerds like we were, this killed the Comedy Central we loved as kids.
Unfortunately. Yeah, I won't repeat too many things I said on that podcast, but it was so interesting to see just how it took off by withholding content, because they made 6. They aired 6 in like 2 months. Everybody wanted more. So there was a new episode once a month for 3 months, and each successive episode would be the highest rated thing on Comedy Central ever, because we just wanted more of that little fat boy, the cursing fat boy. Where is he?
So I believe their original deal was like for 6 episodes, and then they had an option to extend the contract. And if you watch that 6th episode, as I just did recently, the joke is about how they figure their show is about to be canceled.
Yeah, it's called Death.
It's called Death. It is a proto version of the movie because it's the first Terrence and Phillip episode. The mothers, led by Sheila Broflovsky, get offended by it, and they successfully get Cartoon Central to cancel the show and stop airing it. And they have jokes about, like, oh, dirty shows like this, they last like 6 episodes and get canceled. But by the time the episode aired, it was the total opposite. Mm-hmm. It was the biggest thing.
No, you're totally right about that. They reused some of the plot from Death, and watching this movie for the first time in 99 made me think, these guys, if they like an idea, they'll use it more than once.
Yep, yeah.
In a very Mike Myers-y way.
Which they've done the last 25 years. Again, it's very funny to be doing this now because the 25th season of South Park just debuted. Like, that's how fucking old. And we're getting older too, as that famous episode of South Park said. But so yeah, Comedy Central, September 1997. They work out a deal for the rest of the episodes, and they need them now. They want a Halloween special to air in October. They want a Christmas episode to air at Christmas. And then in January, they're going to start airing the rest of season one. And then they've already ordered 20 more episodes for season two. Matt Stone and Trey Parker are the toast of the town. They are the biggest deal in L.A. They're the hot young guys. Every celeb in Hollywood wants to be their new best friend. And if you look up any interviews with them from 1997 or 98, these are guys who are just like starstruck. They're just like, I'm at every party with every famous person now. I'm getting drunk all of the time. Everything's a party. Every celeb tells me they love me. This is crazy. And also, I mean, they're guys in their late 20s. And how does that not like fuck you up, you know?
Yeah. And it's the pre-9/11 good times.
Yeah.
The booming economy.
The last time they like, it's also funny. I found interviews from them in 98 where they say like, yeah, we don't really hate any celebs except Barbara Streisand. We fucking hate her. And then they talk about how she's an out of touch rich person who just owns property in Colorado and talks shit about Colorado. It's like, you guys own a lot of properties now and are richer than Streisand and talk a lot of shit. So,
you know, in the grand scheme of things, as far as rich people go, she's pretty harmless, you know?
I'd say so. Yeah. But for one thing, when she was talking garbage about Colorado, she wasn't being super transphobic. That's mm-hmm. for one thing. But hey, anyway, this is the happy times. So yes, you can see in that Death episode, they're planting the seeds with the creation of Terrence and Phillip and thinking their show is going to be canceled. And that's also about their love of Beavis and Butthead. Here's one thing that I thought was so fucking crazy. Here's how big they were. They got to go to the fucking Super Bowl the year after it premiered, like January 98, to watch their team, the Denver Broncos, win the fucking Super Bowl. Like, how much more perfect can your life be at that point?
There was no greater time to be from Colorado.
But also in the funny timeline of things, they signed on to do the movie Basketball when they thought their show would definitely be canceled after 6 episodes. And so they would later say, like, we shouldn't have done Basketball. Like, it, not just because they think it sucks or whatever, but because they're like, we needed to make South Park and we were filming Basketball at the same time.
Yeah, reading interviews from that time period, they were basically saying, and they were smart about it, in that we know this won't last forever. Let's just do as much as we can while people still want us.
Yeah, and also everybody's coming to you with giant checks. Like, everybody's like, and on top of that, they had their film Orgasmo, which they finished before South Park debuted, but it's being released after. And so it's like, from the creators of South Park, Orgasmo. Which is about a Mormon guy. Like, they fucking love that shit. But also another big thing that happens in early 1998. So they do an episode that introduces Satan, and then they do a big cliffhanger about who is Cartman's dad. And they decide. So Bob, did you get tricked? Cause I got tricked. I was one of those people who's like, what the, on the season two debut.
You know what? I don't think I was like very clever or, you know, a genius about this or anything, but the fact that it was airing on April 1st made me think these guys might have something planned.
Yeah.
And I can't see them giving you a resolution that you would like because they loved fucking with you, you know?
Yes, they're punk rock guys who like fucking with you. Like, that was their, they're Gen Xers who bite the hand that feeds them every day. But yes, I actually believed it was going to be like, yeah, this is like Who Shot Mr. Burns? We'll have the answer now. It's part two. My younger brother said, it's on April 1st. I don't think so. And I was like, no, you're wrong. He was right, and I felt like a complete idiots. And he was, my brother really got me on that one. But yes, that April Fool's Day episode, though, was very important to the future of the movie because it was a full Terrence and Phillip episode. And it was the one where it made it official that Terrence and Phillip are Canadian and that everybody in Canada has beady little eyes and flapping heads so full of lies. And also, it was when they were battling Saddam Hussein, who would then they'd make the villain of this movie.
I forgot how integral that was to the plot of this movie because that episode was so hated
yeah.
that they rarely reran it. So I treasured my recording of it because I thought it was so funny.
It got so much negative feedback that I believe Comedy Central fast-tracked them to finish the next episode and debut it within April because people were that fucking pissed off about it. And still, the ending was like, oh, actually, Carmen's mom is intersex and did not bear him. She's actually the father of him or provided the sperm. So then who's Carmen's mother?
Like, and I think Carmen just goes, ah, forget it.
Yes,
and it
exactly,
ends.
Yes.
Yeah, that, I mean, that Canadian stuff is just so funny. Not because I'm married to a Canadian, but because I'm just like, oh, the Canadians talk like this guy.
Hey, guy.
No Canadian actually talks like that. Yeah. They just make up a fake accent to give all the Canadians.
Hey, buddy. Hey.
Instead of doing like the obvious route of doing the take off, eh, you hoser, they have their own accent and it's great. And it turns out the crude cartoon they were watching, no Canadians actually look like that.
Yes, it wasn't a shitty looking cartoon, it's a Canada looks that way. Now in the movie they do a boot jokes. They make the easier.
You know
job.
What? I gotta say, it's a boat. It's not a boot. You guys are all getting it wrong.
but yeah, I think they just really love that idea of Canada. It's something to rewatch that first season and second season of stuff to be like, oh, here's them working out the ideas of what they want to do the movie. So the movie is certainly being offered to them along with a lot of other stuff. But when did the movie become official? That would be January 19th, 1998. So within 6 months of the debut of Cartman Gets an Anal Probe, they have made a Jeez. Deal for a movie. Like, that's how fast it was. And yes, they had signed the deal. And here's what they had to say about it even then. And this is what they stuck to since then. Trey Parker says, quote, "We would only do a movie if we could make it R-rated. Something like we did with The Spirit of Christmas, the profane underground short that led to the creation of South Park. The Beavis and Butthead movie was just a movie-length version of the TV show. We want to do something different than that." So from the beginning, R-rated was what they wanted.
Hmm.
And
I disagree with them. I think Beavis and Butthead Do America is the better movie. And it would just be weird if Beavis and Butthead were saying, like, fuck and shit and calling each other cocksuckers or whatever. Because they're doing that already on the South Park TV show. You just can't hear it.
I really like both movies, but I think Do America is a better movie. And I think the better thing for Mike Judge is that he got to do 4 years of Beavis, 4 or 5 years of Beavis and Butthead, and then do that movie. This was them making a movie when they didn't know about movies as much. Like, they say that a ton on the commentary. They're like, oh, that looks like shit. That looks like shit. We wouldn't do that now.
What's funny is they made 2 movies before this.
They did, yes. Yeah, but yeah, and also speaking of Beavis and Butthead, several other film executives agreed that they wanted to make this because Paramount, Viacom, MTV, all the same thing. Though Comedy Central is owned by Warner and Viacom at the time. But definitely the Viacom film executive said in that Variety interview, you know, Beavis and Butthead came after the peak. It came too late and the movie didn't make as much money as it could have because it was after the peak of Beavis and Butthead. And they wanted to strike while the iron was at its hottest. So that's why they signed this deal with South Park as soon as they could. But behind the scenes, despite what was being said in that interview, and that was certainly Trey Parker trying to get ahead of the Paramount execs by making it public, Paramount desperately wanted this to be a PG-13 film.
Ooh.
They really, really, really wanted it to be that. And I think you are right that if Beavis and Butthead, on their show, they call each other fart knocker or all that stuff. They never say like a bleeped swear word on the show. They don't say bleep swears. So it would be weird if they just started saying fucking shit in their movie. But on South Park, it started with Spirit of Christmas, which is all swears. Even from the first episode, it's them going like, hey, don't call me fat, buck.
Yeah.
Like, it's
everyone's
always
getting bleeped.
Fuck. Yeah. So it always felt like a natural thing to me, too. So do you remember in the South Park episode Aspen, where they get a
yes,
the timeshare presentation is inspired by the Paramount execs going like, hey, did you know that actually if it was PG-13, it makes more money? Wow, really? I didn't know that. And it can't air on certain networks like that. That was the presentation they got.
Speaking of reusing content, the montage song from Team America comes from that episode. They just used the same song.
I love when they were making Team America. They're like, we already have the fucking montage song. Just put it there.
It's already perfect.
Yeah. That song is perfect.
That is good. It's good.
But Paramount really, really wanted to be PG-13. Because for evil film executives, it literally is dollars they will make. Like, it probably was a difference of $20 to $70 million if it's PG-13 and not R-rated. Like,
and something tells me, just anecdotally, it feels like, I'm sorry to bring this up, but post-Columbine, I think there was more of a crackdown on what movies were being shown to kids and what kids get into. I was getting into R-rated movies at the age of 14 and nobody cared.
Yes,
it could have just been my theater. I remember seeing Scream with my friends and Wild Things and stuff like that, and I was... I didn't look like I was 17. I was a high school kid, and no one was like, let me see your ID.
No, this R rating they're arguing about in 1998 will come and bite them in the ass in 1999 post-Columbine. Yes. Yeah, you are correct. But on top of the R rating versus PG-13 rating, which the guys were pretty firm on, it was also they didn't know at first if it was going to be Warner or Paramount releasing it, because both had by owning Comedy Central, had a 50-50 stake in South Park, which is funny because to this day, Paramount Plus has the movies, and HBO Max, the Warner one, has the TV show.
There's no South Park guys in Space Jam 2, right?
No, there's not.
Only Rick and Morty showed up for that.
So by April 1998, it is finally official. They have made a deal for $15 million to do two more seasons of the show. And they're saying at the time, like, I don't know if we'll want to do more after that. But and then on top of that, they make a deal with Viacom to release the film with Paramount. And that they get, as the guys would say, they were going to get a bunch of money up front to do it, but they would make no money on it afterwards. Like, because Paramount would just use the creative accounting that movies do to say, like, actually, this film never made a profit. But they know that the film cost $18 million or $25 million to make, and it ultimately made more than that in theaters, but they never get that money back. So a deciding factor that made it in Paramount and not Warner was thanks to their big-time movie producer / mega-asshole Scott Rudin. People had fun stories about him being a piece of shit, like throwing stuff at people or like shoving people around and being an asshole as a horrible boss. But then... last year in a Hollywood Reporter, it was not framed as fun. It was framed as like, no, this is a horrible, awful, abusive boss. This guy sucks.
Yeah, I've heard his name tossed around in a lot of stories.
But he did like the South Park guys and got them their movie made. They have a funny story, too. They say that like Scott Rudin, he pretty much was there to just like, if an executive got mad at them, he'd be like, fine, I'll sort it out. But otherwise didn't do much on the movie. They talk about how at their studio making the film, they needed as much space as they could because they're like, every room is being taken. But one room had to be an empty office for Scott Rudin at all times in case he came by, and he only came by once ever to use that office. Like, so that tells you how much Scott Rudin was really involved day to day on it. But Scott Rudin, he did have an eye for talent in Trey Parker because he had actually signed a 2-picture deal at Paramount before South Park with Trey Parker. And so Paramount's like, okay, then we get the rights to this movie because this will be one of your two movies, Trey Parker. But Warner Brothers would get the international rights to the South Park film. Again, this is why the South Park film is on Paramount Plus and everything else is on HBO Max. Though because Warner releases it everywhere outside of America, the movie starts with the Paramount logo becoming a mountain in the show.
It's very Raiders of the Lost Ark.
And that doesn't work when Warner is the fucking logo that goes beforehand. It ruins the joke. Ruins the first joke in the movie. So, yes, here's how insane 1998 was for Matt and Trey. So they're making 20 new episodes of South Park.
Ugh.
They're filming Basketball, which will release in July of 1998. It's a giant bomb. Everybody hates it. And though it does coin the term derp, everybody who says derp now, it's because of Basketball.
Oh, that's from Basketball. Okay, that would later come up in with Mr. Derp.
In the Succubus episode, yeah. Mr. Derp, yerp. And then, of course, they hire a bunch of new writers to work on the show. They actually hate season two. They think it fucking sucks. They say it on the Blu-ray commentary. On top of that, they are making it with Columbia Records, a fucking album, Chef Aid, that they're making with Rick Rubin.
Even worse than Sings the Blues.
Yeah.
It's it's just a collection of other people's music.
Yeah, though, the Rancid song that's on that, I like better than any. I mean, it's not a South Park song. It's just a Rancid B-side. But I like that song more than any song on Simpsons Sing the Blues. The best song on the Chef Aid album is the prank song they did directed at the shitty music producer who they hated on the album because the horny song. Yes, that's, you know the one.
I think it's the only one I actually thought was funny.
And then not only that, a slew of video games. They're working on a bunch of video games. Though the only one that will get out in 1998 for Christmas time is the Nintendo 64 shooter.
I remember there was a PC Gamer cover story with a big picture of Cartman.
Yeah.
And the text was like, oh my God, they made a South Park game. And it was an interview with the two guys saying, we don't want this to be some crappy license game. You're not going to collect keys or whatever. It turned out to be just that.
It was dog shit.
Yeah.
Like all the, I think that N64 one was the best of the bunch because it was just like, it's a Quake clone. And at least it has like a joke of like, I pee on the snowball and throw it and they shoot up a cow on top of your head and your head's in a cow's rectum.
It was kind of like single player horde mode where you're just in these arenas and all of like turkeys or whatever would come in at you.
All the Braveheart turkeys. Yeah. No, that and that was the best one. Like, did you play the Chef trivia game?
Chef's Love Shack?
Yeah, that game sucks.
Or
shit.
South Park Rally?
Yeah, there's a cart game, of course, which, I mean, how do you not make a cart game with Cartman on his Respect My Authority mode and his tricycle?
He's a cart man.
Yeah, it's
perfect for a cart game.
This is a side thing, but I saw them present their first Stick of Truth game at San Diego Comic-Con. I was at the panel as press. First off, it was funny because Greg Miller hosted the panel, but he got to say one thing, and then he completely ignored Greg Miller and did not talk to him the entire time, which was funny. And secondly, when they said, we're finally making a good South Park game, and Matt Stone goes like, I'm sorry if you guys liked those South Park games when you were kids, but they sucked shit, and we're finally making a good South Park game. Which those games are good. I do think they're good. Not great, but good.
It's nice to see Ubisoft making something else than their standard kind of game.
Though, you know what? It was THQ first, and then Ubisoft just bought it from them.
I take it back.
Ubisoft didn't even take a chance on it.
I take it back.
But yeah, so there you go. Season 2, basketball, Chef Aid, video games, and then a movie that is originally scheduled for spring. They said it was going to be a spring movie when it was announced. It shifted to July. what was that first trailer? Well, you'll hear it in the break, but the first trailer was The Simpsons fucking did this too. The misdirect of, you think it's crazy CG, right? But actually, it's a flat 2D drawing.
Yeah, The Simpsons totally ripped off that trailer. I mean, I'm sure it was just lateral thinking, but it was the exact same idea where it's like, you think they're going to be rendering something amazing, but it's really just a crude character.
And then it zooms out and it's Cartman doing his German dance that he did from Chef Aid. And then we'll do the German dance for you. It's fun and gay and tra-la-la, that classic. Yeah, and actually the marketing was, I'll get to it later, but the marketing was the biggest problem they had with Paramount, and they fucking hated the marketing department. And I think it started with that trailer that they didn't make anything for it. They reused a clip of Cartman from the show to do it. So that was in late 1998 where it said, had just the trail like, in 1999 coming. The South Park movie, which is what everybody calls it. Nobody calls it Bigger, Longer, and Uncut. You just
South
call
Park
it
Blue.
How was this made, though, during the production? Well, they rented out a second building next to their main South Park Studios building to do the production in. Concurrent production, and basically Matt and Trey would just have to walk between, and all the other people would walk between the two studios working nonstop on both. Again, insane.
That's crazy. The Simpsons did that as well. And at least in Beavis and Butthead, like, there were episodes after the movie, but the movie was basically like one season's worth of production.
Yeah.
That took up that much time.
Which was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Like, I don't. Actually, this amount of production is exactly what happened to The Simpsons from 06 to 08. Except they also added in a ride on top of that.
On top of video games, season, and a movie.
The film was written by Matt and Trey as well as Pam Brady, who I think you talked about on the first one as
yeah,
well.
Creator of Mr. Wong.
Yep.
And other things that aren't buried, thankfully.
That is an entirely racist turd, but... yeah, she is very busy. She worked with Maria Bamford on that Lady Dynamite show, which I thought was pretty good. And currently, she's working on something with Judd Apatow. I found like five articles from the last like 8 years of like, she's working on a thing with Judd Apatow. I look it up. Movie never came out. I think this movie might actually come out. But yeah, Pam Brady worked a ton on South Park and is a very successful comedy writer to this day. The director on it is Trey Parker. Animation director is the same guy who's been animation director pretty much to this day. Eric Stowe, the college classmate of Matt and Trey, who animated on the Spirit of Christmas even, and who, yes, is Butters.
He's Butters, yeah.
Yes, Eric Stotch, or Eric Leopold Stotch, is Butters. They make fun of him and call him Butters. On the commentary, he comes in and they go like, hey, you're Butters. You sound like this. And then they're like, no, I don't sound like that. Like, yeah, you do. It's a character built on bullying. The bullying of one poor man who, well, I don't want to say poor. He's actually quite rich from being a South Park guy.
I'm sure he's doing well.
Yes, yeah. And yes, he recalls incredibly hard to do. Very hard. He'd never do it again. He's like, I would never fucking do this again. This fucking sucked. Also, one lead animator on it was Ryan Quincy, who would also... go on to be animation director, co-animation director with Butters later in the series in 2000, up to 2009. He left in 2009, but has worked on a ton of stuff and says he's still buddies with Matt and Trey. His current show, he's a co-executive producer on the HBO Max show 10-Year-Old Tom, which I don't know nothing about that. And storyboard director on the film was Adrian Beard, who also has been working on the show pretty much to this time.
I think he was the director of that episode we covered.
Oh,
it was
okay.
Like one of the few non-Trey Parker-directed episodes.
Wow. And he's also the voice of Token Black. It still is, I think, to this day. And he jokes with them on the commentary of like, yes, I was Token Black because at the time I was the only black guy who worked in the company. but he's still in the company, storyboard director on as well, Adrian Beard. And yeah, they did not outsource this. This was South Park Studios, the same as before, though it does look better than the show looked then. On the commentary, they joke of like, you know what? We did an entire episode making fun of George Lucas for re-releasing his films. But when I look at this, I want to reanimate every second of this. But I won't. I won't. But they wish they did.
It does look like a much older production because I think around 2002 or 2003, the animation software got way more sophisticated. They could do a lot more things with it.
Not in 1998. They actually, I found, if you want to know exactly the programs used, they used Power Animator on SGI Silicon Graphics machines. And I know that because SGI put out a press release saying the South Park movie was made with SGI machines. Within 4 years, by the fifth season, they'd switch over to Maya.
That was it, yeah.
And they just say on the commentary, like, I can't believe we outsourced this 3D. This looks like shit compared to the show now. Like, but yes, they wanted to work hard on it, having a texture mapping on the characters though, that it would still look like cardboard cutout characters on the big screen. And it was their first time working in HD and in widescreen, which they also say like, yeah, we didn't know how to frame something in widescreen yet in the show. This looks like crap. But also on the show, they were tinkering with it up to the last minute. Like literally there's a couple jokes in the second half I'll bring up that they said like, that was 2 weeks before it was in theaters. We put that in there.
It feels like with this, it would be much easier to change something because I mean, you're not rendering like Pixar color objects and it's not a 2D thing that needs like so many hands to touch to change it.
That's true. I bet it was like in one day it could render this whole film instead of like one day is like rendering 30 seconds of Toy Story. You know?
Just Woody's hat.
But yes, what was the mindset when working on it? Well, here's a quote from Trey Parker in 2000 about how hard it was. Quote, the hardest time for me was the period from about April of 1998 until the movie came out. We were way overworked doing the series and the movie at the same time. But more important, it was the most stressed out I've ever been because that's what all the critics were saying. South Park is over. The ratings are down. It's over. They were saying, oh, they're making a movie, but the show's over. The movie's going to suck. Who cares? I'd like to say it didn't bother me. Fuck the press and everything, but I can't. It was hard because we knew this movie had better fucking rock. Then Matt Stone continued, you start to doubt it. You think, God, maybe this is a dumb idea for a movie. But in a weird way, that might have helped the movie be better. because we were angry. I really felt like it was our suicide note.
Wow.
We felt like they're going to cancel the show after the movie comes out, but we're going to fucking do it our way. It'll be a big middle finger to Hollywood, and then everyone will hate us and we'll go back to Colorado. Like, that's how it felt making the movie. They're like, this is fucking done. Because they were very testy, even in that 2000 interview, saying, like, people say the ratings are down. They're comparing it to the biggest ratings our one episode got ever. Like, we're still the biggest thing on Comedy Central. What, like, the fuck?
I guess they planned on just earning enough fuck you money to live it up in Colorado for the rest of their lives.
That's what they figured was going to happen. Yes. Yeah. But obviously, that's not what happened. But that's the mindset they were in. Working crazy hard. They're super stressed at all times, and they're hearing from everybody, boy, by the time this movie comes out, you guys are fucked. Like, nobody watches South Park. You suck now. And so, yes, the film is a musical, which shocked a lot of people at the time, though one thing clicked in my head is that I remembered when I saw it in theaters, I remembered watching every interview I could find of them on TV if I saw it, and that included watching the HBO Dennis Miller show, which I would never watch.
I mean, in 1999, it was like, yeah, he's smart and funny.
Yes, yeah, but and they do the Dennis Miller show, and I wish I could have found the clip, but nobody fucking uploaded it that I could find. Trey Parker says, Les Miserables is my favorite musical ever. I love it so very much. And Dennis Miller's like, yeah, it's a funny joke. Yeah, right? And he's like, no, I love Les Mis. And I love Les Mis. To find another person who not just loves musicals, but loves Les Mis like I do, which I listened to on a cassette 800 times as a kid and then saw in theaters with my mom, and by theaters, I mean in a in a production in Florida, like off-Broadway, I was like, I love Les Mis so much. I know. It is so corny. It's such a corny musical.
How did you find out about Les Mis? Because I only knew about it through that Animaniacs episode that parodied it.
Oh,
and I'm like, I think I know what this is, but no one was like passing me a Les Mis tape or they weren't putting on productions in my town.
It was because it was definitely before I was seven.
Before you were seven? Oh, my Lord.
My mom had the tapes of it, and when she would, the cassettes of, and would just play the cassettes while cleaning. Like, when I think of hearing the song Master of the House, I think of my mom running a vacuum cleaner. Like, that's where it connects for me. And then in the mid 90s, they did the PBS special of like the 10th anniversary, everybody's singing it, and so I watched that a million times. Like,
meanwhile, my mom played Meatloaf all the time, so I know every Meatloaf song by heart.
My mom did love some Meatloaf too. I knew,
and
some of the songs,
it's just as gay, that
it's,
music.
Yes, it's all very gay. But for a time, I really didn't think Trey Parker must be gay because he likes all this stuff. But Trey Parker is very straight. Honestly, he likes women too much, as he said in some interviews. but yes. So, of course, they didn't Cannibal the musical, which was a parody of Oklahoma, really. And then they do this one, which they envision is like kind of a parody of Disney. I could go song by song, and I will, and say which musical each song is parodying. Only two songs in the movie are a Les Mis direct parody,
yeah.
I'd say.
You know, it's funny that Shrek got all this attention and praise for, you know, taking Disney down a few pegs. This movie was the dirty, you know, Disney parody.
It was.
2 years earlier.
2 years before. Yeah, man, you're right. But see, Shrek got in that PG rating. More people saw it, you know. But yes, so not only did Paramount not want it to be R-rated, which obviously, like, that was key to the story there. They said that within 30 seconds, they had half the idea of the movie where they said, oh, this should be about the kids going to an R-rated movie and it makes them start swearing and it makes the movie an R-rated movie. So Paramount didn't like that, and they didn't want it to be a musical. At this time, musicals were not popular. There weren't musicals. Like, this is before Chicago, like 3 years before Chicago. And Orgasmo, they wish they'd have done as a musical, they said. They actually regretted not making it a musical. But the music they start working on, Paramount eventually agrees to it, but they try to hide it from as many viewers as possible. You aren't wrong to be surprised that it was a musical. Trey is the lead composer. He writes the songs, but he's partnered with an important person who he says helped make it into an actual, like, orchestral musical movie. And that man is Mark Shaiman. He is, like they say, he brought so much Broadway legitimacy to their film. And that he loved working with them too. Like, he actually joked in an interview, Mark Shaiman is gay, and he joked that Trey Parker is the biggest Les Mis queen he's ever met. Which is funny because Mark Shaman had never seen Les Mis until he was working on this, because he was like, well, shit, now I need to see it.
I was looking at music he did for movies, you know, soundtracks he composed, and I recently watched The Addams Family again, the movie. That has a really good soundtrack.
Yes.
It's not just trying to be Danny Elfman. It's got so many great themes in it that are unique from the TV show. In fact, they don't even play the TV show theme at all in the movie, I don't think.
Yeah, no. Shaman does a great job. Like, it's better. I think if they could have got Danny Elfman, it wouldn't have been as good as that, honestly. And also, Scott Rudin production, that Addams Family film.
That makes sense.
And Mark Shaman, you know, already a very successful Broadway composer. Openly gay. If you see in the movie, there's a very conspicuous man who plays piano for Big Gay Al's big song. That's Mark in there, which he liked. And he is so close to an EGOT. If it wasn't for one British man who won an Oscar after this film, he'd have an EGOT, because he's got a Grammy, an Emmy, and a Tony. But also, Mark Shaman would be familiar to SNL nerds like me and you, because he worked on a lot of SNL stuff. You know, in the Sweeney Sisters, their pianist, that is Mark Shaman.
Really?
Yep.
Okay.
Also, every stupid Billy Crystal Oscar song, Oscar, Oscar, who will win? He wrote that with Billy Crystal.
Well, nobody's perfect.
He wrote the Hairspray musical adaptation that would come later, which that got him his Tony, I believe.
Oh, cool.
And if you're an MCU fan who watched the Hawkeye show on Disney Plus, one of the best parts of the series was they created an in-universe musical about Captain America. He co-wrote that musical for it as well, or the one song that's in it. And so, he jokes that him and Parker, they instantly had chemistry. They knew what they wanted. And like, Trey is like, wow, this sounds so much better than it would have if it was just my shitty demos. I'm so glad he worked with us.
Trey Parker was writing music in the 80s. Like,
yes,
one of his first projects was a comedy album he did with one of the early South Park writers.
Right.
Like, almost a decade before South Park happened.
No, he is a very musical guy. Like, they also, on the soundtrack, his punk band Operation DVDA has a song on it, which, as we all know, stands for double vaginal, double anal.
Haven't seen it.
Their film DVDA.
No, I'm talking about the act.
Oh, me? Certainly not either, yes. The cast was Matt and Trey doing their usual voices, as well as Mary Kay Bergman doing virtually every woman in it, and Isaac Hayes as Chef, still doing Chef. And a bunch of stars are cameo roles, and I'll note as it happens in the film. And then there's other people in small roles that, based on their credits being only other South Park things, I have to think are just friends of Matt and Trey. So,
yeah, some of the guest roles in this movie are very odd, especially when they're playing other celebrities.
Yes.
I'm like, you couldn't just kick Conan O'Brien?
There's a funny story to that
that I'll
save for the second half.
I'm sure we'll get to it soon.
but yes, so everything's in place. But they're fighting Paramount on most things. So I did see them say that they actually like the production department. They said the people who actually helped them make the movie were cool, and they like working with them. And they said that Rudin protected them as much as he could, but the marketing department fucking sucked. They're just like, these guys fucking suck. They wanted to water down every idea they had. Here's another thing that they turned into a joke in the show. Remember all those trailers for Rob Schneider movies? Like, Rob Schneider isn't the enemy.
He's a stapler. Yeah.
Yes. That was because Paramount cutting together a trailer without their knowledge that would go in front of Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me. And it was like, these kids are about to learn a little something. And they hated it so much that they were making fun of it every day. And they actually like had the film negative of the trailer that they then stole and put in their trunk so they couldn't use it. And Paramount was like, we might call the cops on you. Like, you stole studio property.
Wow. I didn't know about this. So it's never seen the light of day?
It was, I don't believe so.
Okay.
I think cooler heads prevailed, and they were able to make the standard trailer that you can look up the trailer, not the German dance trailer, but the trailer that's like actual clips from the movie that I think they were able to see eye to eye to it. But they also said that, like, if they weren't the voices on the movie, they'd have been fired. They felt pretty sure about it. They were having so many fights with marketing over every single thing. PG-13, the trailers, all the commercials for it. And and they felt like they were burning every bridge they had in Hollywood. And then they also were told, like, well, once you're done with this movie, you'll never work at Paramount again. Fuck you guys. And they're like, no, fuck you. You know who released Team America in 2004?
Yep.
Paramount. You know what every South Park movie from now on is going to be on? Paramount Plus.
They're living on Paramountain.
Yes.
With the Moonbeam City characters.
Moonbeam City and Beavis and Butthead and the cast of Yellowstone. They're all having a good time. All right. But so that, they've got their problem with Paramount's marketing. But the real problem is the MPAA. And as you identified correctly, Bob, in between starting this film and the release of this film, is Columbine.
Mm-hmm.
And that
it was movies that did it,
yes, which makes it even funnier that this film is about blaming movies that influence children.
Mm-hmm.
Though the film does also agree that, like, yeah, a kid sees a movie and then they say all the shit they hear in the movie, and that's what kids do.
Yeah.
But
kids are stupid. They imitate things.
But we talked about this a lot in Batman Beyond as well, but the Return of the Joker podcast. But the MPAA had always existed, but the government was getting more and more involved of, like, well, should we have a government deal on this? Should we have a government deal on this? So the MPAA, much like Warner Brothers did with Return of the Joker, they were tightening up way more than they did before because of their fear of being regulated directly by the government. Fortunately, now we know the government would never actually step in and regulate commerce in any possible way.
Absolutely not.
No. But at the time, there was the fear of it. Like, what if Clinton does it? Or Al Gore is definitely going to be the next president, and he'll probably do it.
We all know about that wife of his.
Which is actually funny. In a 2000 interview, they were saying, like, they were so pissed at the MPAA, and they were like, oh, I would have said, kill me before I let the government edit this stuff. But they said after they worked with the incredibly stupid MPAA, they're like, you know what? Maybe it would have been better if it was just directly the government instead of a instead of a business entity doing it.
You know, sometimes I think, do we mention Columbine and 9/11 too much on our network? But then I realize so many things were affected by those events that you can't ignore them.
Yeah, it influenced everything. If we didn't talk about Columbine, we wouldn't be able to say, like, well, why is this thing not in the movie? Or why did the movie get released then? It's like, well, because of Columbine. Like, it's depressing, but it sadly changed everything around it in media.
Yeah. We just recorded The Simpsons, Treehouse of Horror 12. Why were there no creepy credits? Because of 9/11.
Exactly, yeah. So the MPAA battle with Trey has an interesting lineage that does predate Columbine, but Columbine made it worse. In 98, they're trying to release Orgasmo, and they're told it's NC-17, and they ask the MPAA, well, how do we cut it? What do we cut? And the MPAA says, like, hey, we're not here telling you how to edit your films. It's just a general guideline. And then they just deal with it and go, like, fine, it's NC-17. Their small indie distributor goes, like, we'll just release the NC-17. When they do South Park and are told it's NC-17 in their first submission, they then say, well, what should we cut? And the MPAA is like, yeah, here's everything. Just cut that, change that, change that. And they're like, they realize, oh, it's all about business. It's because Paramount is an actual major company. They actually get guidance, and the MPAA didn't give a fuck about Orgasmos comparatively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's a good documentary now, but this film is not yet rated. That was almost 20 years ago. It gives you an insight into what that organization was at the time.
That's just a YouTube video now.
Yeah.
But it was, I remember liking it at the time. And yeah, now the MPAA, I mean, it does still exist and it does impact media in America, but it doesn't feel like, I mean, Netflix just puts a thing on their fucking, you know, streaming. They don't go to the MPAA.
And dicks are swinging around and nobody cares.
Yeah, we got dicks all over the place. Unlike the dick in this movie where they're like, hey, you can't see Saddam Hussein's erect penis. That has to be a dildo. It has to be revealed to be
an eerily realistic one.